Hi, welcome to the ESI What's Next podcast. I'm your host, Alex Feldman, and I'm taking you on a journey to learn about the exciting student entrepreneurs coming out of the ESI program. In the third part of our mini-series, Are Robots Gonna Take Our Farms Too?, we bring back Martin and Alexis so we can have a dialogue between two different stakeholders in the agritech industry. Hopefully through conversations like these, we can help people and help find ways to create farms that can meet the food needs of society. Martin and Alexis, thank you so much for coming back on the show. For anyone who didn't listen to the first two episodes, can you just give a 1 to 2 sentence introduction to yourselves? I'll let Martin start. We'll start with you.
Hi, so Martin here. I'm Director of Innovation at PwC. I lead the startup and scale-up ecosystem in Norway, and I've been working with innovation for the last basically 10 years with my own startups, side hustles, and working in companies like Accenture, Bain, and PwC.
Perfect. And Alexis, just briefly, 1 or 2 sentences about yourself.
I'm Alexis, and together with our teammate, develop our robot, autonomous robot for dairy farmers. Shortly about me, I have background about economic math and work in a different field. So have a lot of experience. And yes, shortly.
Perfect. Martin, I kind of want to start with you of something that kind of came up in essentially both of the last episodes. As a jumping off point, it seems like, let's say, moving forward, we're going to have an interesting kind of differences between, let's say, a country like Norway that has to import all their, let's say at the moment has to import all their foods, to let's say a country like Latvia, where, let's say, they have seasonal access to foods, where sometimes they can grow foods and other times they can't, or they can only have access to certain types of foods, etc. And then let's say, you know, you're calling in from Spain at the moment. Spain's a place that can grow lots of food, sort of a lot of different fruits and vegetables are very local. Is this a dynamic that you sort of see of let's say now Norway and Latvia probably has to import quite a lot from a country like Spain just to get its various needs. Is this a dynamic that you foresee will continue moving forward into the future in terms of meeting our food needs? Or do you think we'll come up with other systems to kind of satisfy local populations?
Yeah, I think partially yes, but partially we are going to see a lot of technology coming into play. And what we are talking about, that there will be certain crops, certain foods that will be more and more grown locally thanks to a lot of new advances in technology, notably robotics, automation, AI, ML, and so on. And that will allow the farmers in the different locations to actually grow high quality crops that before will have to normally be imported. And there is also another trend with the electricity prices as well. I see in Norway, they were discussing if they should stop growing tomatoes. Tomatoes in Norway, they are very energy intensive, right? But I think there may be new technologies coming into play where they will be able to reduce the energy consumption a lot. So it will still be more affordable to produce some of the produce there. Lately, I was listening to or talking to the CEO of a small startup that developed a technology that uses electricity to sort of promote the growth through the soil. So they actually sort of create dielectric difference in the soil, and then the crops grow much more with less input from, for example, the lamps, right? So that will decrease a lot. So for countries like the Netherlands or the Nordics, that was pretty interesting use case. I think we are going to see also, I mean, given how the trade it is and the logistics are quite stuck after COVID and during and after COVID. So I think we are going to see more openness from the farmers and from the industry to be disrupted and to adopt new type of pilots and also new startup technology.
Jumping off of that point, kind of sort of continuing with you, Martin, Do you also see one of the trends that I'm seeing, and I think this would be, I don't know, particularly relevant for a place like the Nordics or honestly any cold weather country, is I think you're starting to see more and more of a shift from, let's say, large land, physical land farming to vertical farming, urban farming, et cetera, just as of, let's say, we have limited space we can expand horizontally, but in theory, we can kind of expand as vertically as we want in theory. Or let's say there's a lot more opportunity to expand upwards, or there's also a lot of, let's say, if we're talking about urban environments, a lot of spaces that are kind of not in use that could be retrofitted or repurposed for this. Do you see that also kind of, it seems like those two trends are sort of merging together to have sort of a relocalization of food systems?
Absolutely. And one of my ex-colleagues in Vertical Urbane, he works in a startup in Copenhagen called Seasony, and they actually do that, right? So they're seeing a lot of growth. And I think the convergence of several trends, like we see the vertical farming is now really taking off. But also, if you put that together with micro fulfillment centers like AutoStore or Ocado, for example, then you start creating micro supply chains that are very local. So you could have a very vertical farms in a part of the city, and then through micro fulfillment centers, you actually can deliver fresh produce even to your Amazon locker. I mean, I think we are going to see a lot of new things coming on, especially on the local sphere. And I think given that the oil price, electricity prices, supply chain are disrupted, I think it's going to be perhaps more and more competitive to be leveraging technology to create local produce.
Gotcha. I think one of the things that I was seeing that I found interesting, just of kind of wrapping up this point, it seems like you might be able to create these microsystems, but even on almost like almost an apartment level or something, where you could actually almost have almost like a quasi cooperative, or my family does a CSA where they've kind of collectively are paying a farmer to bring them, you know, during the main season, bring them food, crops every week and produce every week. But it seems like you could do that on, you know, an apartment building scale or complex or whatever, and that becomes part of your, not to say I want to talk about it, but you know, the future of living and collaborative living, which you're starting to see, is I think another kind of side trend that's starting to pop up in sort of micro communities.
Super interesting. And I think I'm sure there is a startup somewhere thinking about how to provide that as a service, right? So, and if you look at, for example, if you are renting in a collective or a flat, so you are paying some, let's say, a couple of hundred euro just for sort of the real estate type of commercial things. What if you pay another 100, but you actually get the local produce from your rooftop, right? And there is another company that is actually doing the entire job. But I think is in that case, it's even more about business models and simple digital solutions and actually just basically change management of the people to understand that that's an option and they should push it in their own communities. But I think that the technologies are basically there for us to play with those type of business models.
I can add here about business model that it's true that now we see that tractor producers are changing their business model. And old model was only they produce and sell. And now this model is changing that they have this like tractor or something, some locally, and you can rent it as a car. So it's more friendly for smaller farmers. And we also thought about this like test phase when in Baltic state, we can just rent and we will get feedback from our customer. In the same time, they do not need to buy because it's quite costly for them. And pay in one moment a big amount of money. So yes, I think it's going like our future that we everything rent if you do not use, we rent. I think it's also like a trend what we see with cars. If I do not use, I can rent it.
I think the other thing that I'm seeing in the space is almost what I would call the modern variation of the old school printer or razor blade model, except of it old school, right? It was if you had your printer, you bought the hardware, and then you had to, you know, refill cartridges. And essentially you're seeing kind of the modern version of that, which is you buy the hardware, usually at some kind of discount, and usually the printers were at a discount compared to costs. But instead of you renting cartridges, you're actually doing some kind of subscription connected to data and software and whatnot. And it's kind of, you know, the 21st century version of the printer model, right? Of, you know, everything's a subscription nowadays. So instead of just selling cartridges, we're selling subscriptions. Is that, Alexis, going towards you first, is that something that you think, you know, where, let's say, you would sell the actual robot for cheap and there'd be some kind of subscription around the data or the essentially, you know, connected to the almost the robot brain? Is that something that you guys are thinking about, considering? Does it make sense? I'd be curious to know your thoughts.
Yes, we thought about this business model, and it's quite real. I think that we create some robot, and after we just add some features like tasks. If farmer would like, I don't know, work in current field, so he choose current program, and he pay for this program, like one of this possibility. I do not know how it will work really in real world for now, but in the future it can be like in a car that seat. They warm seat this program. So something similar can be in the future, yes.
Would, out of a thought from that, is there, I don't know if there's the potential of this, and to me it seems like there probably would be, but is there the potential for there this almost being that you have almost like the equivalent of like an app store connected to your device that you can then download the appropriate programs, and maybe it's not even necessarily something that, let's say, your company creates, right? But if you can actually, or the other way around, right? Or you could actually outsource the programs that you create to other devices and stores mm-hmm. that can be downloaded. And it seems like there's going to be a lot more, almost the equivalent of APIing in this space, right? Where people develop the actual software programs and then cross-utilize it across the appropriate tools.
Yes, I think it's quite possible scenarios that we will just allow some, I don't know, scientists, for example, to develop some program. For example, AI who understand where the crop or the berries are seed. We can use their program and just pay for them. And farmers will pay like rent for this. It's, I think, quite possible scenarios in our future.
What do you, a question, and I was going to open this up to the floor. I haven't seen so much of this actually happening in the agricultural space. What do you see as the, let's say, potential barriers preventing kind of this type of crossover happening, but kind of between different players in the industry, whoever that's kind of to the field?
For now, yes, for now, this is time when this business model is changing at first, because I also heard about new robots who offer rent possibility, but they work with different with different companies who offer something, for example, wheat removing, and they use this wheat removing system in their robot. So it's two companies in final product. So it's something similar. Yeah, what about we are speaking now? But in future, I think we'll use more and more these things.
I think I'm going to ask a question towards you, Martin, kind of jumping off this point a little bit. It seems to me that one of the things that's happening right now is that, let's say, the lessons of the last 20 years that we've had coming out of kind of the IT revolution is starting to make its way across pretty much almost every industry you can think of. And as industries start to, let's say, operate in a similar fashion to kind of what the internet and the app space has been doing, you're starting to see similar kind of business models and let's say just also just ways of doing business are starting to pop up. I'd say one, is this a trend you think on will continue? And two, what do you think, let's say, this will allow us to kind of unlock? I sort of think personally, as an aside, I think one of the reasons that I'm with you that biotech is going to be one of the biggest things over the next 20, 30 years. I think it's going to be as big, if not bigger, than IT was for the last 20. But I think part of the reason is because of what IT unlocked. I don't think we would have been able to do the same things in biotech if we didn't just have this kind of IT revolution. It's allowing us to do things in biotech that we weren't able to do before. I'm just curious what your thoughts is. Is this something that you're seeing across different industries? Do you think overall that's a good thing? Yeah.
It's a very good point. I absolutely agree with what you said, that what the IT has unlocked for biotech is similar for hardware. So we are going to see a lot of possibilities with IP in with business models and so on. I don't think that is going to be the trend. We are going to see more of that. We are going to see a lot of innovation. We are going to see a lot of hubs. For example, in Paris, they have this AgTech hub as well, and it's quite big. So we are going to see what we have seen in the IT industry with hardware in the next 10 years, I think. On the other hand, I work with few hardware companies over the last years, and there are still a couple of differences between software and hardware that we need to be mindful of, right? So one of them is the digital maturity of the customer, right? So of course, when you get the phone and you can do a lot of things with the phone, people got quite easy into Facebook, Instagram, all of those type of things. Now we are talking to a farmer. Right, the farmer needs to start dealing with sort of technology. Right, so one thing is the digital maturity, and also a typically conservative industry that has been there for thousands of years.
Can I give a little bit of, let's say, potential pushback? Not complete pushback, but I think a little bit of pushback is, I wonder that. I think right now we're hitting a unique moment on a generational level. And I think part of what you're kind of seeing on a generational level is, right, I would argue the millennials are the first generation where they were what I would call the IT transition generation, where they kind of, let's say, they grew up with, it was sort of the industry was growing with them, right? They weren't necessarily digitally native, but it was sort of, they were teenagers and growing with the industry. So they were kind of the first ones that kind of grew up with it. And then any industry younger than that, or any generation, I should say, younger than that is sort of, you know, digitally native. They grew up in a digital world. And I think what you're starting to see right now, and why I think some of these issues might be not as important as you might think, is now millennials are starting to kind of grow into decision-making positions and becoming, you know, managers and you know, moving their way up the various industrial ladders. So some of the things that you're saying within 5 to 10 years might not actually be a problem, because the actual people making the decisions are actually comfortable with the space.
Yes, no, I fully agree. I think that's a trend that is just going to get better and better, right? As you said, so I fully agree with that. The other point as well is distribution, right? So when you want to scale, you need basically a good chance for distribution. And I see with hardware, if you nail distribution, is everything, right? So, and this is sort of a question back to you guys. How do you think the value chain at the moment is going to react when we see the potential for more decentralized way of doing things? And I'm talking about supermarkets. I'm talking about they are really the holder here for distribution of food, and they have always been. How do you see they are going to react towards a model where farmers could go directly to a consumer via digital means, and new business models? And basically, as you said, Alex, farmers will be more digitally native more and more, and they will be able to approach the customer perhaps directly, because we know today a tomato in the farm is like perhaps 10% of the price as you get in the supermarkets, and it's all the middleman that is taking most of the cuts, right? So it's I would like to hear from both of you guys. What do you think?
Yeah, Alexis, I'll let you start with yours, and I'll kind of jump in second.
It's a good question, I think. But yes, now when everything is quite centralized, I will say, centralized. Everything what we buy, for example, for hardware is from China, unfortunately. If we buy from German, it's from China. When German buy from... with our supply, I'll say that it will be quite big challenge for us, for everyone, for who create technology, who work with this technology and find good distributors in the future.
I on one level, I agree with you quite a bit, in the sense of, I think there is going to become a democratization to some extent, right, of farmers and allowing farmers to be more, let's say, directly connected to the consumer. And I think what that will potentially lead towards, right, is you'll start to see more, and you see this in a lot of other places, right? You'll probably start to see more specific like brands, almost like kind of specific farming brands that kind of feed into whatever the trends are of the day. One thing though, we haven't really touched upon this, and we kind of should, and it kind of almost loops us back to the beginning of the conversation, is I do think to a certain extent, there's a limitation on the food side, or at least on the crop side, to how local you can actually get, right? And I don't think you can localize everything. I don't think it makes sense to localize everything. I think there's, let's say, certain crops for certain regions that it just doesn't, just the it's still going to be cheaper to import it than it is to try to you have to spend so much energy because it's just not right for that environment, almost no matter what you do. I don't want to say it's exactly like this, but it's let's say in certain environments, it's almost like right now the World Cup's going on, right, to kind of date when this is happening. And there are certain outdoor stadiums in Qatar where they're using air conditioning, right? And they just sort of, you have these environmental things like that, where just to overcome those types of things to make, like, you know, in this case, is Qatar making an outdoor stadium usable? You have to air condition it, even though it's outdoors, which is kind of terrible environmentally. I think certain crops, you're going to run into those types of problems in specific geographies, right? Probably deserts in the Middle East is one of them. I would say the Nordics is probably a different one, but for different reasons. And so I think you're going to have a thing where it's like, okay, there's going to be a certain amount of locals, and you're going to have local brands around that that'll work. But there'll be certain crops that, I don't know, let's say, I imagine a big one would be, I don't know if, let's say, the Nordics are ever going to really have, let's say, local chocolate, right? Or cacao beans. Like, I can't imagine that, or coffee. I can't imagine that ever making sense, at least in my mind. Maybe I'm wrong, but then if you're still shipping it over such long distances, and right, you're still probably going to have something, I would say ideally for a lot of the, or at least for the end user and for the farmers, ideally a more consolidated supply chain, right, with not so many middlemen. And I do think some of these things will hopefully cut out some of the middlemen. But I can't imagine how you're going to, you know, if you're getting coffee beans or cacao beans from, let's say, Latin America, and trying to do something in the Nordics, I can't imagine cutting that out completely. And so I think it'll get better.
Of course. Yeah. No, of course. I think there will be some selected crops, as we have been discussing, right? And coming back to the other guests, I mean, for instance, berries is a really good example for that, right? So there will be selected crops that will make more sense. And there will be some specific things that we have not thought before, for instance, inland aquaculture, right? So those things that we have not really done before, but we are seeing in Norway some indoor salmon farming, sort of on land, not in the fjords. So we will see more and more of some things that are going to be disruptive, but other things, for instance, why to do chocolate or grains or some things that, or bananas or avocados, I mean, they are very specific, right? So we should not try to disrupt everything, but I think part of it will be more suitable. And I think it's going to be really case by case, actually.
And what I can maybe add here that, for example, local berries, fruit, and so on, it will be possible to have local these fruits and something longer time, because our technology will be, I hope, able to create this climate, microclimate for the berries, for example, and also in the future. We now see, for example, raspberries, which grow in summer, and raspberries in autumn, and they are just selected. So it's also our future. What we will see, but yes, we will. Unfortunately, do not see, I think, Baltic bananas.
Yeah. But I want to jump off on something, because I think you bring up a good point here too, is I think one of the issues we have right now with our food systems is we're losing so much to waste. It, like before it even remotely gets to the end consumer, I think we're losing, it's somewhere between like 40 and 60%. I think it's like 40% once it gets to the distribution centers, and even like another 10, 15, 20% afterwards. And I'd say not 100% sure, but I would say in theory, right, as we localize, that should bring some of this down probably significantly, right? As we're shipping things shorter distances. I mean, in theory, you know, for some of the things that we discussed, you might be getting it directly off your roof or somewhere close, right? In theory, the waste on that should be close to zero, or as close to zero as we can get. And I think that I'm a little behind on this, because I used to give talks on this, but I know a couple of years ago, the expectation was we're going to have a production gap of something like 40 to 50% of our food needs over, I think, starting around 2050. And I think things like this will hopefully be a way to alleviate that at least a little bit. Again, this is tying to something you said, Martin, right? This is a kind of multivariate complex problem. Let's say different solutions are going to help bring those numbers down in different ways. We kind of need all of them working together. It's not going to be any one. There's sort of no silver bullet here, right? It's going to be a couple bullets here, a couple bullets there, and together it's going to work together. But we need some from column A, some from column B, some from column C, to actually get it functioning. So,
no, I think we are going to see quite a lot of cool stuff coming on in the next 10 years. I think there are, as you said, Alex, the IT revolution the last 20 years have unlocked a lot of stuff, and we are on a point where a lot of technologies are available almost off the shelf for entrepreneurs and inventors to create a new future. So I'm very, very curious to see what's next on our table.
I think our future will be quite interesting. What will happen next? But for everyone, I think everything in future depends for us, what we do now. And so if everyone have something interesting and some challenge, what he can solve, I think just need to get up and go to do.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the ESI What's Next podcast. ESI is a program aimed at fostering socially responsible, environmentally sustainable student innovation through education and new venture creation. We're grateful to the European Regional Development Fund, Printify, SEB Bank, and Remy for their support. Tune in next week to find out what's next in the world of student entrepreneurship.